Yeah, I was working on the wrong schedule this morning. I apologize. I thought, so I apologize. I'm saying I had the wrong schedule this morning. I was thinking we began at 9 with the worship, so my apologies. Yesterday we went to Hershey, the park, and denial is as real as ever. I tried to go on one of the rides. It's like the half moon thing that does this, and then it goes up and around and around, and you know, and I stay away from all these things because my stomach can't take it. But I tried one. Like I said, my denial, and oh my God. Within 2 minutes, I had my belt open and my pants, and I just was sick. So. It was funny, even in an amusement park, you find shadow. Yeah. You know, here's all these things to kind of take you out of your daily world and the world of gravity, I mean, all these gravity-defying rides and fun things. And then there's this one funny thing that happened where, you know, they got all these the chocolate things in costumes. You get the Hershey chocolate people, and then you get the people dressed up like Hershey Kisses. And we loved it. You know, we have pictures taken with the Hershey Kisses, man, and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, we were sitting down after we do this, and then we hear this couple with a very heavy South Philly accent. And they get the picture taken, and they're hugging the Hershey Kisses man and all this. And they say, hey, he looks down, he sees his watch is half off. He said, the Hershey Kisses person tried to rip me off. He said, I'm going to go after that goddamn Hershey Kiss. I'm going to get him. He tried to roll me. So even in Hershey Park, stuff goes on. The Hershey Kisses guy tried to roll me, he says. He had a good laugh. Also, those of you, when you come back next year, do check out the Napoli restaurant. It's a real family place. The pizza over here, by the way, the Roma pizza is very good. The people from Sicily. The other one, it's the whole family's there. And Christopher said, I want to go back there. That's how he said, how come? Because they treat you like a family, Daddy. And they take you in the back, and they make, you've had limoncello. Limoncello is a wonderful drink from Naples, where the lemons are as big as grapefruits. They're like that, really. And it's a lemon and sugar and alcohol drink, and it's incredible. And the mother makes it. They gave us some of that, you know, because I brought their own bottle of wine that we made. And then they give us the special homemade white wine that they make. So it's a real, go back there and check out the family. Michele Conforti. Well, look, I know a lot of stuff was generated yesterday by the talk. And a lot of people talked to me afterwards, and a lot of emotions, a lot of ideas, and all. And I hope you have some way to process this on your own. Again, whether it's your therapy, or your loved ones, or supervisors, or good friends, or your small groups, or whatever. Because you have to have a container to put it in. That's sort of the long and short of a lot of this work. People say, how do you change? You got to have some kind of container to put this stuff in. You can't do it on your own. Okay? And you really can't see all of your complexes on your own. You know? That's why I was, again, kidding around with the image of the mirror. You got to have some kind of mirror. And I saw there was a whole list of questions that came from... what do they call themselves? The morphogenetically and intellectually impaired or challenged people. So I will try to get to some of the questions at the end, but I was talking to the committee, and they said, really, try to stay with your agenda first. And that's my plan. And one question was, well, what about the sequencing of my talks? In summation, the sequencing, as I have tried to do this, I have tried to do this, is to have an overview in the first one, in the second one to present more in-depth the idea of fields and patterns, because again, that is central to my work. Yesterday we dug in with real life, and I don't think it gets more real life nitty-gritty as it did yesterday. And today I want to talk more about how we can begin to visualize the ways we go about denying things. Through communication, through cinema, through literature, okay? And try to tie up some of these pieces to give you something to go home with. Because one of the questions was, well, what do we do with this? You know, give us something practical. And I do hope yesterday was practical, you know, in terms of what does this really look like in real life when somebody's in denial. The way to begin with today. Okay, thank you. An article I recommend you read at some point, again, regardless of your profession and fields of expertise or interest. It's written by a pediatrician turned psychoanalyst in later life. His name is D.W. Winnicott. And many of you know his work in infant-mother relationships. And he was one of the first to say that when you look at an infant and a mother, you really can't talk about two people. You talk about a dyad, a functional dyad. And I think it's really accurate that it's a unit that's working together. Anyway, he worked with someone named Melanie Klein for many years. Melanie Klein was a brilliant Freudian psychoanalyst. Was one of the first lay analysts, i.e. Not a medical practitioner. And Melanie Klein had a very tough life. She was hospitalized many times in her own life. And you find that when you read the biographies of many of these pioneers, there's been a lot of struggle in their life. I mean, if you know Jung's life, his mother had been hospitalized repeatedly. And for some reason, all of the records of this have been stricken from the history books. She was in a number of local sanitariums, especially after the death of her first son, Paul. So Jung grew up in a home where there was, you know, we talked about death a lot yesterday. Jung grew up in a home where there was death. From the start, there was the ghost of the dead brother. We talked about sort of secrets, and it was never really talked about. Melanie Klein, as I said, was hospitalized for very disturbing depressions and fits she would go into. Anyway, she came up with this theory, not a theory, she was able to articulate something called a manic defense. And for my money, I find it one of the most important concepts for understanding denial processes. Let me read you. This is from Winnicott's article. He wrote this in 1935. It's in a book called Through Pediatrics to Psychoanalysis. Okay, Through Pediatrics to Psychoanalysis, but it's chapter 11. And he writes, and this would be, I think, really significant for us as Jungians as well. The manic defense is a part of one's own manic system which is unable to give full significance to inner reality. There are fluctuations in one's ability to respect inner reality that are related to depressive anxieties in oneself. And then he goes, I'll read that again. Yep. The manic defense has to do with being unable to give full significance to inner reality. That's your key line here. Full significance in reality. There are fluctuations in one's ability to respect inner reality that are related to depressive anxieties in oneself. Yeah. Yep. Well, I'm glad you find it important. Again, this has been central in my work on denial systems. Okay. The manic defense has to do with the inability to give full significance to inner reality. There are fluctuations in one's ability to respect in reality. There are fluctuations in one's ability to respect in reality that are related to depressive anxiety in oneself. Oh, sure. Now, I gave a presentation about probably 10 years ago to the Psychoanalytic Society in New York about this, and I talked about externalizations of internal manic defense processes. And I talked about how these different manic defenses became manifested in the treatment relationship. So, to ground what I'm getting at is, the manic defenses are those things that come up inside of us that work to obliterate interiority. Interiority is a major term for us. Interiority has to do with the inner world, the inner life. One's sense of who they are, one's sense of one's vision of themselves, one's ability to allow for the world of fantasies to emerge, to allow for the world of just ruminations to come up, to just sit and meditate. All of that is killed off in manic defenses. And what we do is we start doing things. We do a lot of activity. Robert Langs has another contribution to this, and he calls it type B communication. B is in blue, okay? Type B communication. And he calls it action discharge. Whereas action discharge. And he said it's a way of acting in therapy where the patient is suddenly doing a lot of things and asking the therapist to do a lot of things. Would you change the time today? Would you change the fee? My job just changed. Would you bring my wife in? Would you bring my husband in? Could you see my kids? Would you sit next to me? Would you honor? Would you loan me a book? Would you do on and on and on and on and on? And he began to see that all of these things came because there was so much internal distress. It's like, you know the game, the kids are hot potato? You take the hot potato. And that's what it's like. Because there's something so disturbing in the inner world, some realization, some memory, some fear, some hope, and you can't deal with it. So interiority gets externalized. And the same way that we use these defenses internally, like, well, I'm just going to go out and take a run today, I'm not going to meditate today, I'm not going to do this, you begin to do this in your relationships. And this was where I made my sort of inroad with a lot of this work in terms of interactive dynamics. Yeah, I think the relationship is between interior and exterior. Yeah. Okay, what I'm saying is we got the hot potato. Maybe it's the... Let's say, for instance, there are certain symptoms one begins to have, physical symptoms. You know, you ever get those scary feelings in your chest? Okay. And then you suddenly say, I don't know what the hell it is. I got some kind of funny palpitations here. I got some kind of strange thing down my left arm. It's just stress. Okay. Let's go out dancing tonight. Okay. And you go out dancing. Let's go out. You know what? I've been so stressed. Let me go out and run another 5 miles. Or let me just go do something. Go cook a meal. Okay. Now, Winnicott would tell you that most likely what's happening is there is anxiety, that maybe there are some coronary problems, okay, the symptoms. Rather than live with that anxiety and that fear, you jump and you start doing something. It's the doing, okay? The doing something is a way to get away from the interiority, to get away from the dread, oh my God, are these signs of a heart attack? Are these signs I have some kind of heart problem? No, get away from it. When you get into the interactive world, and this is, as I'm saying, this is where I began to make my contributions to this field, is I looked at the various kinds of configurations that we get involved in our relationships, and I did it by looking at analytic relationships. And again, this could be extended, okay, to marriages, families, cultures, organizations, teams, all of it. And I began to see that the way we configure things often was a representation of the way we dealt with the defenses internally. So in the same way we try to get away from the hot potato by doing things in our own personal life, we began to do things in our relationships which were very similar to the same kind of defenses we use on ourselves. And the way I began to see this in the treatment like relationships were, again, all this doing and activity. This is why, as an analyst, now, whenever a request is made of me, would you change my time today? Would you do anything? Okay. I have a pat answer I'm going to give. Let's just see what comes to mind. Well, what do you mean? Can't you just give me an answer? And I'll explain, no. Because often there's so much meaning in what you're asking me, and I can tell you right now that I don't know what this is about. I don't know what the real meaning is, asking me to see your husband, to see your wife, whatever. And I feel as though if I answered you quickly, yay or nay, I would be doing something injurious to you and to this treatment. I want to give this time to see how your unconscious views this request. I think it's such a respectful way of dealing with this. And you see what you're doing? It's a major, major intervention. It's the same thing in life, you know. It's a major intervention because what you're doing is the manic defensive process, which is working to obliterate the anxiety, is like this. It's like a wheel that's gaining momentum. If they're at the point of asking you to do something, you know it's working inside them too. You see what I'm saying? See the outer as a reflection of the inner. And this is something the alchemists talked about throughout the ages. They said if you look at the outer world is a reflection of the inner world. And that's why Jung looked to alchemy as an outward manifestation, representation of the individuation process. He said we now see in the outer world what individuation really looks like. Okay? That's really how simple it is on one level. So in the same thing here, when you look at the relationships, you can see. Again, this is why I showed the slides of the things like the water and the rippling and all that. Because as you begin to look at the rippling in human relationships, you can begin to sense that rippling is going on in the interior life as well. Let me put a stick in the wheel to stop it from spinning right now. Because as something gains momentum, well, what happens? The car gets going faster and faster and faster and faster. Somebody's got to put a stick in the wheel. The stick in the wheel, when you say, well, rather than say yes or no right now to your request, let's just give it some time. It's a beautiful intervention. You see what it's doing too? It's a model. It's saying to somebody, let's reflect on this, which is what the whole thing is aimed to obliterate in the first place. You see it? So this is why I give so much importance to the configuration process of psychotherapy and relationships. Now, you could take this much further in terms of your observational skills. And really, I think I said before, if I have any ability at all, it's I like to observe things, I like to watch. Yeah. Like the movie, what was it with Peter Sellers? Being There, I like to watch. That incredible scene with Shirley MacLaine. You just watch it. Anyway, look at the way people walk. You could see the way people walk, whether you're a body therapist or not. See, they touch the ground. There are a lot of people that walk and they really do not touch the ground. There are other people that are so cemented, like they call them Neapolitan shoes. Remember, in Naples, what they would do to people, they didn't like them, they put them in a tub, put concrete in them, throw them in the water, and drown them. Huh? Neapolitan shoes. That's funny, huh? Huh? So you got the one hand, you have sort of the ascendant, the inflated, the ethereal, and the other one is just so cemented in matter they can't move. Other things I look for, and again, see, this is stuff you begin doing naturally when you look at people. Anybody that's overly involved with their own religious background, anybody that has to wear it as a badge, and I found across the board. When it has become a badge, it's a tremendous degree of denial underneath it. What I'm saying again is I find that when there is an over-identification with one's spirituality, they talk it, they live it, they dress it, on and on. Fundamentalist, okay? Fundamentalism. What is fundamentalism? Fundamentalism basically is the most rigid structure you can find. I was consulting in a case, an organization where the leaders were fundamentalists, literally fundamentalists. And I said, you're not going to make a change in the system. said, what are you talking about? I said, you know, if you've gone so far as to become a fundamentalist, it's telling you if a structure is held that tight, it's a Humpty Dumpty structure. You know it's going to crack. If it opens up a little bit, because what do we do to protect ourselves? We get tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. You look at people that have been incested. You look at their bodies. You will find what Wilhelm Reich called character armoring. There is such armoring around parts of the body. It's going to take a lot to get into there. Okay. So, if you look at somebody who's got this very, very strong religious orientation, you wonder what's driving it. Okay. Other things you look at is voice. I'm very attuned to voices. And I've noticed in liturgical music, for instance, one of the things you pick up about it is an absence of bass. You ever notice that in liturgical music? We had a woman, somebody you may want to invite, who's ever on the nominating committee, to invite as one of your speakers someday, is Therese Schroeder Shakir. Therese Schroeder is a gifted woman. She is an angel. And I mean that in many ways. She's an angel. She's developed the field of music thanatology. And she does music with the dying. Well, anyway, I can only describe her as saying that if she sang in Times Square at rush hour, she would stop the traffic. I have never heard a voice like this in my life. She has many CDs out. She's a recording artist as well as a therapist and writer. They were singing at the end of one of these CC conferences, and I was looking around. She was singing, and I thought I heard four voices. And she said, "What they do is—I think I don't know the terms—some kind of bone resonance, and it's as though the whole body was really different." Anyway, the point of this is, it's so ethereal, and I happen to like a lot of that kind of music. There's no bass to it, though, and a lot of church music is like that. Is that another expression, like the expression of the water that ripples, of what's been introduced into it? Is it a way to explain to us that there's something about the baser parts of reality in life that need to be omitted? There's an internal sense of harmonics one has. There's an internal sense of taste one has. And you know, in listening to it, you feel really great and all that, but there's something that's not quite balanced about it. Yeah, Therese, I think it's T-H-E-R-E-S-E, Schroeder, how do you spell Schroeder? S-C-H, yeah, and you can look on the website, Chalice of the Repose Project, hyphen last name, Schecker. Yeah. Look on the Chalice of the Repose, R-E-P-O-S-E, a project. Anyway, you listen to voices. And what you want to hear is the voice grounded somewhere? If it's not grounded, you'd be thinking again right away, again. It's striking there's an absence of ground and solidity to the voice. Any voice that is overly pious or mystical, overly spiritual. Now, what I'm getting at with all these little examples, I mean, you talk about practical things in the questions. What I'm trying to do is to walk you through a little bit of how I work and how I go about the work of trying to observe the presence of denial systems in individuals. Now, the stronger the denial, the more difficult it is to crack. That's number one. The more difficult it is to help the individual open up to find out what's underneath it. So even if the individual is not aware, which most times we're not aware of what it is we're denying, the beauty is the repressed and the denied is always visible. And there's a beautiful quote here. This is by a psychoanalyst named Zielborg, and he writes, talking about the fear of death and the denial of death. He says, "The fear of death undergoes most complex elaborations and manifests itself in many indirect ways." I'll read that again. Again, this is really central to this, because what we're getting at here is the different ways the denials and the things that are being denied will inevitably manifest themselves and show their face. He writes, "The fear of death undergoes most complex elaborations and manifests itself in many indirect ways." Now, we have a beautiful example of this in literature. Well, many examples, but one really profound one is in the story of Dorian Gray. Okay? The picture of Dorian Gray. Long story short of this tale, it's of a beautiful, narcissist-like man. And in many ways, as I reread this story, I think that in part, this is really an extension of the Narcissus myth. Remember the Narcissus tale? Where Narcissus was unable to love. He was unable to ever give himself to another person. And we begin to find out why. And you look at the origins, the initial conditions of his life, he was conceived in rape, in violence. His mother was raped by the river god. Anyway, the most powerful scene in the whole Narcissus story is a reflection episode. When suddenly he's down by the water washing his face and he sees himself for the first time. And he says, basically, who is that? Who is that creature? And he says, am I to woo you or are you to woo me? And he goes down to hug and he drowns. What's very interesting, if you read this book carefully, you begin to see there are a lot of parallels with the Narcissus tale and Dorian Gray. For instance, we read, this is when one of the lords meets and talks to Narcissus. He says, "The moment I met you, I saw that you were quite unconscious of what you really are, of what you really might be. There was so much in you that charmed me that I felt I must tell you something about yourself. I thought how tragic it would be if you were wasted. For there is such a little time that your youth will last, such a little, little time." And then Narcissus says, or the author says of him, of Dorian Gray, "The sense of his own beauty came to him like a revelation. He had never felt it before." And then he goes on to say, he said, this is right after his picture was done, the portrait of Dorian Gray was finished. And he says, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if the picture would age and I would never lose the luster of youth?" And the parallel I'm making between the Narcissus myth and Dorian Gray is that the moment, if we take a freeze moment, a freeze frame moment of when Narcissus sees himself but he doesn't die, if we look at the sort of the follow through of the dark side of that reflection, you have it in the Dorian Gray tale. Because what he then does is he makes his pact with the devil. And he says, "I will do anything to let the picture age and for me to stay young and beautiful." Well, as you, most of you probably know the story, we've heard in grade school or whatever. Remember what happens, though. He makes a pact, he stays a beautiful young man forever, and he goes through life doing what he wants to do. Cruel acts, drug-induced states, brutal sexuality, exploitation of others, and there are no signs of remorse. However, there are signs somewhere. And this is the piece I'm getting at. What we find in Dorian Gray is that there is a recording, so to speak, of what he's done. It's recorded and reflected in the portrait. Everything that he has done, the heinous crimes, the exploitations, the murders, they're all reflected in the portrait. And occasionally he'll go up into the attic where he says the doors are barred to the attic. He'll go up and he'll look at it and he'll just get sicker and sicker because he sees the beautiful youth in the picture is suddenly this disfigured, horrid, tortured man. What's up there? It's his soul. Think about the image of this thing which captures what he has done in his life as he tries to avoid it, to deny it. And go back to this quote I gave in the beginning by Zielberg when he says, "The fear of death undergoes most complex elaborations and manifests itself in many indirect ways." But this is what I'm saying. It's indirect in that it comes through portraits and derivatives and configurations, but the experience is never lost in the human psyche. This is why our work, again, whether as individuals, whether as consultants, whether as parents, whether as partners, is to try to see the portrait, to have access to the attic room so that we can really see what's going on and then have communication between the two worlds. And then toward the end of the story, on page 233, he says, this is after he's aged and many of his friends have died, and he says, "I can't live life like this anymore." He said, "I have lived a lie. I have lived a folly thinking youth was the god to be worshipped." He says, "Youth wasn't it. It's just some unripe fruit." You know? He said, "All the experiences of love that I could have had with another human being, having family, having career, having passions, they're all gone. Because I never had them. The chances are gone." He said, "What I want to do is I want to go back and deal with that portrait." Okay, this is a beautiful literary example of one dealing with the repressed and the denied soul. And again, what's so profound there is he wants to make contact with what's been denied. And at the end of the book, I won't read the passage, but he says he goes back up there and he undoes all the locks on the door. You can hear the imagery too. All of the ways that we try to lock and bar off from human consciousness, the experiences. And he said, "I had peace because I knew I was going to live as an honest man, i.e. live with my truth." He goes up there, he sees a horrid, horrid picture. Now, if we could just freeze the moment of the picture for a minute, what it is capturing again is the human soul that will record and register and reflect on whatever we've done with our life. And there's no escape in that. And this is not some Old Testament Yahweh saying, "Oh, look what you're lying." The point is, what do they call it? The Akasha Records in Eastern traditions. Right? The Akasha Records, that it's all registered somewhere. I gave the image, I think, in the opening lecture of the Egyptian model of death, or the Egyptian thing of when they weigh the souls, the way how we've lived our life. This is what you have here at the end. And he said he went up to and he felt free for the first time in his life. Why was he free too? You see, when he was undoing the locks to the door, this is a moment of extreme consciousness. And I know a couple of questions were asked yesterday about the role of consciousness. This is it. Consciousness is when you can actively face the truth of your life and then do something about it. Remember I gave the definition yesterday of conscience. Conscience is the capacity to know what is right in our particular life and then doing it. He did it. And he knew what he was going to have to face because there were no illusions anymore at that point. There were no illusions about what was in the portrait because he'd been watching it all the way through. And he was gloating over the fact it recorded it and he got off scot-free. And now he says he knows no one gets off scot-free. There's always a price to pay and there's always consequences to what we do. He goes up and the people in the house claim afterwards they heard this horrible scream that there was a fight. They go up to find him and what they find is the body of a wretched old man at peace with a knife through his heart. It's like Jesus in the desert for 40 days wrestling with the devils and the demons, you know? It's interesting that what Jung says about the beginning of analysis is the first stage is often dealing with shadow. You know? And as I open this talk and what the theme was all the way through this is the degree of denial of human processes is more prevalent and more pronounced than I ever wanted to realize. And what we're trying to do today is look at ways of detecting this and gaining access to it. While we may not have portraits to look at in our own attics, you know, what we do have are stories. What we do have are our experiences. And if you look at every experience as being a derivative representation of the entire life one is living, you're going to get the tales. A simple example, and this I have in my book. So is a paradigm similar to what I'm trying to get at? In that there's something that's been denied, and this thing is still going to make itself known through the way we live our life. This, in my book, I talk about is a case of somebody I supervised named Julie. Julie, a very talented psychotherapist, doing really exquisite work with patients. I find that she sets a really good frame. She has a very good understanding of herself on many levels, excellent understanding of psychodynamics for people. Something inevitably happens early on in the treatment where she does something very strange. She suddenly, for no reason at all, include third parties in the treatment, for instance. Well, why don't you bring your husband? I said, what are you doing? She said, I don't know why I'm doing this. So she suddenly cancel a session, change a time, for no apparent reason. Now, as an extrovert, often the way I work is I have to say things out loud to get it. You know, introverts are much better at that. They can just do it internally, and that's why I love teaching also. So anyway, I said, you know, we've got to figure out what this is about. This is where the work of the ontological approach comes in. The ontology is, if you just name the experience, it's striking to me that, which is really a mode of interventions I really have begun taking. And I said, you know, it's striking to me that so many of these therapies that begin really well, they suddenly end abruptly. Freeze the moment again. When I talked about holographic models, what I'm saying is the entire system or entire organization or whatever is embedded in that one moment and expressed in that one moment. Usually when there are pivotal events in one's life, usually when there are major issues that have never been dealt with meaningfully enough, they are going to stay as central issues. And it's going to be a contiguous line. You never get over it? Many times, no. Until you do work. However, what I'm saying is, you're going to see it. See, this is why I'm interested in patterns. Patterns reflect the archetypal. Patterns reflect the field you're in. Patterns reflect what is denied. Patterns reflect what's in Dorian Gray's attic. If you have the eyes and the ears and the sensitivity to do this. And this is an inborn capability in all of us. Now, I'll cut to the chase with part of the story. It's a fact that every living organism survives because of our innate ability to read patterns. Every animal, every single cell organism, every organization has got to read the economic climate, right? Well, you know what? Humans often obliterate their capacity to accurately read patterns. Why is it, if you think back, those that were married, had a first marriage or whatever, and you say, well, how did I get there? You know, in retrospect, all the writing was on the wall. Or why did I do what I did in that first job? Or whatever, whatever. And you see the writing was on the wall. How come I didn't do it? And I think I hit the issue with this. The thing that obliterates or minimizes our capacity to accurately utilize what is innate in us as pattern readers is what? The big D word again, denial. Denial seems to be that process in human nature which causes us to not use our ability to read patterns effectively. Why? Because if you read it, there's a lot of meaning that's got to be made of it and the things you got to do with it. Number one. Okay, back to this case. So she's doing this work, and I finally say the words, it's striking to me. And again, I didn't know where I was going with this at this point. I wasn't sure. I said, it's striking to me that so many of these cases begin so well, You're really helping these people. It's growing. It's taking. And you see, I talked about language the other day. I really use language this way to express things because I'm trying to get what's innate in it, and I'm trying to flesh it out as much as I can. So it's striking. This stuff which takes off so nice in the beginning, there's so much vitality in this thing, and then it suddenly just ends. What is it? Then I had it. What do you hear? Huh? The pattern changes. But you see what I'm saying is with the skill, you can make a very accurate assessment as to what it is. And that's why, again, whether it's Henry Lee doing as bizarre as blood splattering reading, whether it's the oceanographers reading the waves, whether it's the guy from the FAA reading the angle at which the plane goes into the water, you can read this stuff. Do you know there's a group out in Florida, and what they do is they read crash patterns of planes and they do computer simulation of these? I'm reading a report on the Lockerbie disaster right now. It's on the internet if you want to get it, air crashes. What I'm looking at is how they can tell from the crash site what happened. You see the model I'm working with? So she's doing this. Then I say these words. And right, the pattern changes. But more specifically, it's striking that something that began so well, that had so much future and life to it, just suddenly ended. Then I asked the question. And it was a supervisee. I had this kind of... And again, you got to be very careful how you speak with people. You have to really respect the nature of your relationship. This is somebody I've known for many years. She's been in my one of my groups and all. And I had said... And again, remember, I am doing some distorting here, so bear with me. I said, what is it about life and death? And I'm kind of talking out loud. And I said, who died at a very young age? I said, tell me about the child that died. She said, what? And she said, oh my God. Something I haven't thought about in years is she had a baby that died of SIDS, sudden infant death. And silence in the session. And crying, and she's saying, but no, but I thought I worked it through in therapy. I said, it was never worked through in therapy.